For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of the New Evangelicals Podcast. Now, let me just say right now, I actually have a lot to get to in this intro. So bear with me. We have some big announcements. And also, of course, I want to intro the guest. So let's start with the guest first. On this episode of the podcast, I had the pleasure, the privilege of interviewing David Hayward, who is the brain and the person behind the Naked Pastor Instagram account and online website, essentially. Now, David, I mean, I first met him through social media because he makes these amazing drawings about the church and Jesus and looking for, just a more inclusive Christianity. I love his stuff. It's so well done. Turns out he's also an author who wrote a book called Until Doubt Do Us Part. It's about what happens when you're deconstructing and your spouse is not. And I'm glad I got him on the show because I get this all the time. A lot of people on the Instagram account of the New Evangelicals and on Facebook are always asking, what do we do if our spouse isn't deconstructing, but I am, or what do we do when political views are really different? And I brought David on to talk about that. So on this episode, we kind of dive into a lot of that. We dive into his book and just, you know, I asked him because he's been married for, I think he said, like 30 or 35 years. What makes a marriage successful for you guys? And he just offered so much wisdom. So I really hope that you enjoy this episode. Now, that being said, I have one very cool announcement. We have our first ever sponsor for a podcast, which is so exciting, so cool. So as many of you know, my friend, I mean, I think he's my friend. I'll put it this way, a guest on the show, Trip Fuller, who, by the way, Trip, if you're listening, I got many people saying how much they loved our episode together. So Trip Fuller, he's a theologian. He wrote a book about open and relational theology. He does a lot of work when it comes to talking about social justice issues and how as Christians do we think deeper about economies and just living that kind of more just life. Well, he is doing a series with Diana Butler Bass and Brian McLaren, who are two heavyweights of the deconstructing movement. I mean, they're kind of some of the OGs, really. But when I was a wee little kid, Brian McLaren was writing about the emergent church and writing books about that. So him, Diana Butler Bass, and Brian McLaren got together and they put together a 6-week like online course exploring how Christianity has changed over the last 20 years. And this is really partly due because we're nearing the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And so they got like this 6-week course together. Now, the course is a pay what you can course, including paying nothing. So the course is available for free if you can't pay anything. Of course, if you can pay something, I really think it's worth it. These guys do great work. They put a lot of time and energy into creating this kind of content to help us think deeper about our faith. But I put a link in the show notes that you can click on it and you can sign up for the course. It's a 6-week course. You can listen to it. If you miss one of like the live recordings, you can listen to it later on. It's totally available. And I really recommend you guys checking it out. Of course, you know, Trip is great, and Brian and Diana, they're just great people. And I know they have so much insight, especially when it comes to really where we've been the past 20 years as a Christian faith in America and how 9/11 really shaped a lot of that. So I really recommend checking it out. So thank you, Trip, for sponsoring this episode, which is just so cool. So I appreciate that. So check it out. Like I said, friends, it's totally free if you can't afford anything. But of course, if you can, we recommend please paying whatever you can to download the course. It will really, I think, be so worthwhile. Okay, second big announcement. And I know I have a lot going on, but I just got to do it. We have finally announced the next stage for New Evangelicals. We have launched the Finding Our Voice campaign. We are looking to create funding, monthly funding, to help us create a docuseries called Community Conversations, where this will be essentially a documentary where we elevate stories inside of our community that the church needs to hear. And I think that that stories that people need to share. So we are looking forward to this. Now, we announced this on our Instagram last Wednesday. So all the details can be found there. We have a highlight called Finding Our Voice. It breaks down the budget, where the money's going, how much we need to make monthly in order to make our actual goal. So that's all there. And I want to say already a huge thank you to everyone who has already given monthly. Listen, I'm going to be honest, all right? Giving trauma is a real thing. It's a real thing for me. I hate the idea of asking for money, but the reality is, friends, we don't do anything behind a paywall. We are totally crowdfunded, and this is just what we need to go to the next step of the New Evangelicals. We want to continue to build what we're doing. We want to expand Zoom groups. We want to get this documentary going. We're going to go and become a registered nonprofit, and that just takes money and a monthly budget to make it happen. So thank you in advance to everyone who has given, and if you're interested in helping us out, please check out the highlight, or if you want to check out the actual campaign, I have a link in the show notes. You can tap on that and check out what we're doing. Any questions, you can always email us, thenewevangelicals@gmail.com. Okay, this is probably the show's longest intro, but I'm all done now. So here is my interview with David Hayward. I hope you enjoy it. David, I truly appreciate you making time, especially on such short notice, to come on the podcast and talk. So thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, for sure. Before we get into our main topic, I kind of mentioned this before we started recording, but really, what goes into the brain that makes such amazing, you know, drawings? I mean, what is your thought process? Because I see them every time, and every time I'm like, just when I think they couldn't get any more creative or any more, you know, poignant, you just knock it out of the park. So what goes into it?
Wow, man. Thanks. That's a huge compliment. I appreciate that.
Definitely.
I don't know. I think I just think in terms of pictures, like this house we're living in. It was an old rundown bungalow cottage on the river. And I saw promise. And when I walked in, I could actually see it, like open concept. I could see the rooms. I could see the colors. I could see everything. And my wife couldn't, she struggled, and, you know, I drew it out, and we, you know, went ahead and did it, and we're living in it now to this day. It's beautiful. We love it. But so I think that's just the way it is with me, is I picture ideas. And, you know, some of my cartoons are pretty good and others aren't so good, and some are great, but it's just me trying to, you know, paint a picture instead of write 1,000 words, although I do like writing too.
Well, I'm sure, like me, you have moments where you really try and work on a post or something to share, and you're like, okay, this is gonna kill it, and like it just, you know, it just tanks. Then you have something you're like, yeah, I just threw it together, it just takes off, and you're thinking, I know
if I could learn that secret, man, I'd be rich.
I know. Yeah, you would be both. So you know, why don't you, I've watched your account from afar. I don't really know much about you though, as the person. I mean, your account is The Naked Pastor. I'm assuming at one point you were a pastor. What is that story? What's that journey that got you from point A to now doing this stuff?
Okay, long story short, I grew up in a Christian home. We moved around different denominations. We moved a lot. My dad was a cop, and he got transferred a lot around the province. I live in Canada. And, you know, we just went to whatever church was convenient. We weren't devoted to any one denomination, although I was baptized Anglican, which in the States is Episcopal.
Okay.
And I just, you know, went up through the ranks, got born again in a Baptist church, switched to Pentecostal, went to Pentecostal Bible College in the States. That's where I met my wife, Lisa. Then we went to Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. I got my master's in New Testament studies. And then I went to McGill University and got my equivalent to an MDiv, got ordained in the Presbyterian Church in Canada, served the Presbyterian Church for many years, and then quit there and switched to Vineyard, which is which is quite a, you know, the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yeah, it really is.
And and then, you know, I served the church for many years. I say roughly around 30 years. I served the church as a pastor. I left the ministry in 2010. I started my blog Naked Pastor in 2005. But I left the ministry in 2010 and decided to see if I could make Naked Pastor go as a full-time gig, and it has worked so far. So that's my story in a nutshell. Basically, Naked Pastor means I was a blogger, and I just wanted people to see the real life of a real pastor, to see behind the curtain, see what really goes on in the life and mind and heart and the church of a real pastor, not, you know, the sermons I'm preaching and the church growth and then the money and the music and all this. I wanted them to see the struggles and my personal struggles and doubts and fears and conflicts and money problems and all this kind of stuff, marriage problems, everything I wanted them to see. So that's what Naked means. It's just me being open and honest about my life as a pastor. And when I left the ministry, I decided to keep the name because, well, it'd become a brand by then.
Sure.
And now a lot of people think I'm kind of doing pastoral work online. So I decided to keep it.
Yeah. Was your, you know, a lot of your drawings online are very, you know, LGBTQ plus affirming, et cetera. Yep. Did your theology change over time to kind of get to where you are now? Or were you always kind of behind the scenes, even when you couldn't be publicly, personally, always kind of that way?
No, I was never, I never felt like I was an imposter. I always found, and that's why I say when I grew up in different denominations, like we went to the most convenient church. So actually that was in my blood to go to the church I liked the most.
Yeah.
And where I felt I could be most authentically me and grow. And so I, you know, I went to the Presbyterian church and I grew a lot theologically there. And then I wanted to go back to something more experiential. And so I ended up in the Vineyard and I grew a lot there too. And so, you know, that's what, my theology evolved over time. My deconstruction, was kind of like a slow glacial melt. It's kind of like climate change, just slow, but perceptible. And there were episodes, of course.
Yeah.
Of crisis and trauma, but no, it took me decades actually to go through that. So it was very slow evolution.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. And then you eventually left church culture, left the ministry, and you're doing Naked Pastor full time.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I left the ministry in 2010. I didn't intend to leave the church, but things kind of happened in such a way that I live in kind of a small city and there weren't many options. And plus I had a reputation and, as a pastor and so on. Yeah. And, you know, there's a church about an hour away that we can visit and we're very comfortable there and we're friends with people there and the pastor and so on. And, but we just can't get there that often, especially now during COVID, but my wife's a nurse on shift work and, you know, this and that. But sure. That's a church I'm comfortable going to and visiting and hanging out with. Yeah. But so, yeah, as a full-time, you know, dotted line member, yeah, I'm not there. But in terms of feeling free to visit a church, I'm okay.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you wrote this book, Till Doubt Do Us Part, When Changing Beliefs Change Your Marriage.
Yeah.
And the reason I even reached out to you is because I saw that you wrote this. And, you know, in my community of people, a lot of people message me consistently daily, you know, hey, my spouse is not deconstructing. I am. And that usually tends, and this is a broad, you know, stroke here, but it tends to be, you know, I'm becoming a little more progressive in my politics and in my theology. My wife or husband is not, et cetera. It's creating friction. And, you know, you look like someone who's a little bit wiser than I am. You know, you're a little bit ahead of me in the journey of life. And frankly, we need people like you who have that wisdom to kind of pass on to, you know, to people. That is, it's a very biblical concept to use the term, right? You know, the idea of generational wisdom. And I think that you've a lot to offer in this topic. So my first question really is, why write the book? I have to assume it came out of some kind of personal experience.
Yeah. So when I left the ministry, actually, Lisa and I, we've been married now, you know, a long time. And we were married, you know, she was 19, I was 21, very, very young, very much in love, very much joined at the hip, very much enmeshed with one another.
Sure.
And, you know, we went through our education and everything and through ministry as a team. And really, we were on the same page, on the same line, you know, everything all the way through. And then when my deconstruction sort of started really unfolding, and then 2009, when it really reached its peak, and then which culminated in me leaving the ministry a year later. That's when it injected sort of a crisis in our marriage relationship, because now, when I left the ministry, I left my job, my vocation, my paycheck, our friends, our church, our support. We had to file for bankruptcy because we were so poor. Wow. Our kids had left home, so empty nest. Lisa decided to go back to university, or to actually go to university and get a nursing degree. She started her nursing degree at 48 years old.
Wow.
And, I'm off doing my thing. And so we were living very much separate lives, which is very new to us. Like, we were always like I said, joined at the hip, on the same page, doing everything together in terms of ministry. Hmm. And now we were doing different things with different circle of friends and relationships and schedule. And that was a couple of years in our marriage where we were touch and go. We really weren't sure we were going to make it. There were times when we really thought maybe this is over, and because we felt we'd lost the glue to our relationship. Mm. Mm. And it took a lot of work, with a lot of talking, a lot of therapy and counseling and coaching and support and, patience for us to figure out how to relate again as a husband and a wife. So it was very, very scary. Mm. And so since then, like, I started talking about deconstruction in 2008, 2009, 2010, now we're in 2021. Now everybody's talking about it. But I was starting to see, and I was helping people through their own deconstructions. And what's one of the things that came up was my wife or my husband is on a different page. I don't know what to do.
Yep.
We feel like we're being pulled apart.
Yep.
And so I decided to, I wrote, I don't know, 30 or 40 posts on it, and drew a bunch of cartoons about it.
Classic.
To help people through it. And I decided to assemble it into a book, because I've seen, I'd say most people who marriages who go into deconstruction, one or the other or both, most of those marriages I see blow up.
Yeah.
They just can't sustain the tension and the conflict and the difference in the relationship, and I see them blow up. So I wanted to provide a sort of a guideline for people that, we made it, maybe this will help you make it. Or I this is a disclaimer, if you realize that maybe you're not to be married anymore, that's okay too, and how to do that in a amicable way. So that's what the book is about, and it is helping people, actually. So I'm pleased to know that.
Yeah, well, it was recommended in we have like a Facebook community group of about 1,500 people, and your book came up several times. Yeah, and people recommended it, and it's also, I think it's on, someone just assembled an entire book list for us. It's like 100 books are on there, of like the New Evangelicals community book list. I think that book is also on there. So
cool.
I've heard great things. It's interesting you bring this up, because I've been thinking a lot about, I wonder why, this is such a point of tension. And listen, I mean, I'm 5 years into marriage, so I'm still new and we're working on things ourselves. But, what I have learned is that, marriage can be strained for a lot of reasons. And I think when you get married under the pretense of, till death do us part, and also our faith is never going to change, therefore it's all good. And then one day someone's faith starts changing, it's very anxiety-inducing. I mean, my wife probably deconstructed before I did in a lot of ways. And as a type A personality who wants to control everything, right, it was very terrifying for me, because I'm like, well, what if she becomes an atheist and like becomes this horrible human being, right? I mean, just all these thoughts. And I had to really recenter myself and say, surely I can trust the divine to handle this. And I can trust my wife, who I love to death, I can trust that she does not want to blow up our marriage or not train our children up in a healthy way. But it was a learning curve, man. It really pushed up against my Christian sensibilities at the time. So what what are some themes, you know, that you talk about in this book for, you know, for like that? I mean, are those some of the reasons why you see marriages strained? What are some of those themes that maybe you've seen?
Well, yeah, it's funny the way you said that, where you said, you know, what if she becomes an atheist and becomes a horrible person? That's right. That right there says a lot, right? Where we equate atheists with being horrible people. And so,
yeah.
Well, with Lisa and I, you know, we met in a Pentecostal Bible college, and we journeyed together through Pentecostalism, evangelicalism,
yep.
Presbyterianism, Reformational theology.
Yep.
You know, yep. We both missed, you know, more modern worship music,
yep.
And you know, all this kind of thing together, and we migrated into the Vineyard Church and all that kind of thing. Totally. So you know, we were kind of traveling together, joined together, very much on the same page, like I keep saying. But then it became apparent to us that we're very different spiritually. Mm. Mm.
Yeah.
And we felt the freedom to, now that I was no longer in ministry, you know, the fishbowl, yeah. No longer under the microscope, and that we were basically free to be who we wanted to be. That was really scary. That was really frightening for me, actually, to, you know, realize that I could be whatever I wanted to be or do whatever I wanted to do. And nobody could say anything about it. Nobody was watching.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was kind of very frightening in itself. And so, you know, Lisa is very much, you know, she has indigenous roots, and she's very much interested in a kind of spirituality that's very earthy.
Yes.
And, you know, forest and nature and, yep. And spirit and everything. And I'm more of a mystical kind of a bent.
Yeah.
And philosophical, so on. And we were just kind of drifting apart. We had to figure out, we had to actually sit down and negotiate. How are we going to do this? Like what the heck is going on? And we had to figure out, okay, what did we fall in love with? I certainly did not fall in love with Earth because of Earth beliefs.
Right.
Like when I first saw her walking into the college cafeteria, it wasn't her belief system that caught my eye. There were other things that caught my eye.
right.
And you know, I fell in love with this sort of this wild, untamable, funny, wise, gracious, loving, beautiful woman.
Right.
And she happened to be Pentecostal. And right. She fell in love with me with all my attributes, who happened to be Pentecostal at the time.
Right.
And we realized, you know, that's what we fell in love with. I fell in love with the believer, not the beliefs.
Right.
Right. So
right.
I fell in love with Lisa, who thinks this way.
Right.
I didn't fall in love with the person who thinks this way, who happened to be Lisa. So that's the way we figured this out, was I'm in love with her. I'm in love with the way she thinks, the way she lives, the way she feels, the way she is spiritual, right? And not with a checklist of faith statements.
Yeah.
So, and when we realized that, what the glue that actually held us together wasn't compatibility of beliefs, but love and mutual respect. I'm going to trust her with her spiritual journey, and she trusts me with mine.
Yes.
And we admire one another because I trust her. I actually trust her with her spiritual journey. She's the wisest person, the wisest guide for herself, as I am mine. And to appreciate and respect that, right? Mm. I know it gets difficult for some people. And, you know, this book is even being used in terms of relationships with families and so on, because, you know, our families can have different beliefs and so on.
Yeah.
But even I know it gets really, really difficult when people maybe get alt-right in their thinking, or conspiracy theory kind of people, or, you know, very conservative and fundamentalist maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know that there are relationships out there that they're figuring it out. They're figuring out how to do it. And then some can't. So I acknowledge that in the book. But that's what it was for Lisa and I, was getting in touch with the root. And that was our love. I fell in love with Lisa, who happened to be, and she fell in love with me, who happened to be. .. And that's what
kept
us together. And now our marriage is better than ever.
Mm.
Yeah.
Let's kind of hone in on something you mentioned. When people start going more alt-right or more conservative, I mean, it's no secret to in America. We've seen a huge rise in Christian nationalism, you know, the insurrection and the whole 2016 and 2020 election. And certainly, and I came out of the evangelical church as of 3 months ago.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, you and I have in some ways a lot of the same elements, but I'm no longer there.
You're fresh, man.
What's up?
You're fresh out.
Yeah. And I was asked to step out because of this platform. So it's, there's a lot of relationships that have been lost, et cetera, but that's for a different time. That's for my counselor.
Hey man, that's my blog got me in trouble. And that's why I eventually had to leave the ministry. So I totally get it.
Yeah. I feel that. But so we know that we've seen this rise of like this, it's a weird, you know, combination of a fundamentalist approach, of an absolutism approach. And it's taking over people. And a lot of spouses are telling me, you know, my husband, my wife, they're way into this, and it's putting a strain on the marriage. Yeah. How do you, you know, if someone says that to you, how do you respond to them? Like, what do I do? How do I navigate this?
So, and here's the thing about relationships. It takes both parties.
Right.
So even my book, Till Doubt Do Us Part. Whoops, Till Doubt Do Us Part.
There's
the cover. If only one couple is interested in making the marriage work, then you're in trouble. It takes both people.
Yeah.
It's like relationships are like a crucible where you enter. And when one changes, the other has to change. You have to, like when Lisa changes, I have to adapt.
Yeah.
Or compromise or understand or move along with or disagree or renegotiate. So, right. And so with me, if I change, Lisa is required to negotiate or try to understand or come to an agreement or make some kind of change or adjustment or compromise. It's the person who refuses to change that actually, and refuses to grow, they're the ones that are actually destroying the marriage. I compare it, the analogy I use is an elastic band. So my wife and I were joined by an elastic band. We stretch and we move and we're bouncing back and forth and all this.
Yeah.
But if I stayed in one spot and Lisa's wanting to grow, and she keeps stretching out, she's wanting to grow and progress and move and change and transform, and I refuse, I stay right where I am.
Right.
Eventually she's growing so much that she actually breaks the band. Actually, she didn't break the band. I did.
Right.
I'm refusing to move along with her in some way. Right. And that's what often happens in relationships like this, where one or the other couple, they're wanting to grow. They're wanting to move. They want you to come along with them, but you refuse. And that inevitably is going to break the relationship. And it's the person who refuses to change and grow that actually breaks it, not the person. It's often the person, especially women, it's often the person who is doing the changing and the marriage breaks up, who's blamed
for
breaking up.
That's right.
Especially women.
Yep.
If a man changes and everything and the wife is called a stick in the mud, whereas a wife changes and everything, she's called a Jezebel or whatever and breaks the marriage. But it's always the person who refuses to change and that wrecks the marriage.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Do you think, I mean, the politics of the of our day are just so, they're just so entrenched, kind of like how religious identity is formed. You know, political identity is like another formation of who I am and what I stand for. And when my spouse isn't for that or is drifting away from that, it creates major tension, obviously.
Yeah.
We're, and I know it's very situational, but like, are there some general principles of how does someone detect, okay, you know, I tend on my account to get a lot of women as well. I 70% of my followers are female. And so I get a lot of women who say, you know, my husband is like, he loves Trump, loves Tucker Carlson, and I'm rethinking this stuff. And I don't feel like I can talk about it. How does someone like that, right? Like, how do you navigate those waters? Because part of me says, well, you know, the vows that we take, say, you know, for better or for worse, not for if you're only a Democrat or a Republican. But I realize, like you said, in real life, how much tension those ideologies can bring into a household or to a spouse, you know, relationship. Right. What are some parameters that maybe you've seen that are like, here's a healthy idea of you guys can coexist and get along great and love each other, and here's not so healthy, you might need therapy or something like that?
Yeah, well, the problem with you might need therapy is that it's the person who knows they need therapy who needs it the least.
Yeah.
It's the person who don't think they need therapy who's the one who's going to reject it. And you know, they don't need it. But, I mean, you know, Lisa and I, we've gone for marriage counseling so many times, I can't even count. And, you know, we're together for a couple of meetings. And then finally, around the third meeting or something, the marriage counselor says, okay, Lisa, you don't need to come back. I just need to spend more time with David.
Classic.
Because I'm the problem, right?
Yeah.
So, it's difficult these days, you know, across the world, around the world, in every country. It's not just America, because this sort of alt-right movement is, you know, this populism is increasing around the world. And I think it's a response to progressivism. Fundamentalism is reactionary. That's all it is. It's a reaction to progress and change. And it's like the Taliban. It reacts to threats upon the status quo. It's control and authority and power. And that's all fundamentalism is. It's not a movement. It's a reaction to movement. And so we're going to see it more and more around the world. It's going to get crazier as you know, our ideas progress around all kinds of issues, and, you know, including sexuality and gender. And I think it's just going to get, there's going to be more and more of a reaction from fundamentalism and conservatism. So, I know it's difficult because we see it here in Canada too, even though politics and religion are still separate here, not like states. So, you know, when people love Trump, let's say it's often mixed in with this weird Christianity. I think it's weird. And and so it gets really, really, really complicated. But, you know, I've got people in my life, loved ones in my life, who tend that way, and who are suckers for conspiracy theory stuff. Yeah. And so I've done research on it. How do you relate to somebody you love who is, you know, you're concerned about them getting further and further in conspiracy theory stuff. And there's good articles out there by psychologists and counselors and cult deprogramming specialists and so on. Yeah. And their number one thing is don't try to correct them. Just listen to them and just ask questions, respect them, and just respond with questions. Yeah, but if you believe that, then why this kind of thing? And but you never challenge, you never sort of call them stupid or whatever. You just sort of listen and compassionately just ask questions, because that's usually what breaks that downward spiral, is when they can't answer a question that they should be able to answer.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
No, that's great. It is, people a lot of times, especially, let's assume for a second that our audience has all grown up in Christian, in evangelicalism. We're taught that marriage is sacred, marriage is for life, marriage is a big deal. And a lot of those things, I think, for me, are still very true. Marriage is sacred. Marriage is a big deal. It's a big commitment for people. I understand all that. But obviously, things in your life change, and like you said, people grow and they shift, and some don't. I'm trying to think of a good way to ask this, but how are there warning signs that maybe you talk about in the book? Of like, hey, you should be maybe concerned that the person you're married to is not healthy, and is doing damage. Like, I feel like you have this idea, this beautiful picture of unconditional love, right? We show each other unconditional love, and that can be used by abusers to gaslight people, right? Okay. Into like unconditional love. And I think a lot of us don't want to give up on people. We want to see that through. We want to see unconditional love through. We want to be like Jesus, right? So how do we navigate that very fine line between empathy, mercy, love, and grace, and love for our spouse versus I have to stand up for myself, this is unhealthy, something needs to change?
Well, in my opinion, you never back down from health. Never. Hmm. You never back down from your own personal safety and your own personal health and well-being. It's like the proverbial oxygen mask dropping from the ceiling of the airplane. You need to take care of yourself first. And that's got to be job one, always. Priority number one is to take care of yourself. Yeah. Now, already there's many Christians who are like, I don't know about that.
Right.
That sounds selfish to me. And we need to take care of others first and put our own needs aside for the needs of others. Exactly. But no, I really do believe the healthiest people are those who take care of themselves, and then they have the wherewithal to help others. We see this over and over again, where mostly wives are sacrificing their well-being, their health, their identity, their happiness, everything, their safety even, to maintain a marriage only because they were told they should.
Right.
So that's one of the things I really challenge about marriage. Things have changed. I have adult children. Lisa and I have three adult children. Mm-hmm. Their ideas about marriage are totally different than Lisa's and mine. Lisa and I got married in 1980. So we've been married 41 years.
Mm, wow.
And we're madly in love still. But when we got married, we never did the thing until we got married.
Yep. Yeah.
We had this traditional view about marriage, and we had these ideas about sex that, when you have sex with somebody, you give them your soul and you'll never get it back. And, all this.
And so I was raised, and my wife and I both waited until our wedding night. Same thing.
Yeah. I get it. I don't regret that. I have no remorse about that. But our kids have very different views about marriage. Very, very different views about marriage. Mm. Now it's like you stand one of your kids on the side of the road and said, I dare you to cross this road. You've got a 50-50 chance of making it.
Right.
That's what marriage is to our kids. Because really it's 50-50 chance it's going to make it.
Right.
And meaning that the marriages stay together.
Right.
I bet 50% of the marriages that do stay together shouldn't, or wish they didn't, So I think the rate of happy marriages in this world is pretty low.
Yeah. So what do you think about that? I mean, to be honest, I thought about this as well. I really try and be as much in the tension as possible about all kinds of things. And marriage in particular, the idea of two adults in a lifelong partnership, we'll say that definition
right,
for now.
Right.
You know, I do find something very beautiful about sticking through tough times. Like how you even said, you and your wife worked through it and you're more in love than ever. And I think that there's something beautiful about not giving up on something because it gets tough. But also, I realize that a lot of marriages that maybe even I've known about or have seen have been at the expense of usually the wife, you know, so the husband can live his life. Do you think there's a way to salvage that concept of like a marriage being that way? Or do you think it's just like times have changed and we have to rethink what even marriage looks like?
Oh, well, listen, man, you can't hold back the tide. You can't. I mean, that things have changed. Yeah. I have ideas about marriage have changed and they're going to continue changing.
Yeah.
I mean, marriage is a social construct. The biblical idea of marriage is very, very vague. I mean, it starts with polyamory,
yep,
and having many wives, and then it ends up with Jesus, you know, vaguely talking about marriage, attending a wedding, you know, no marriage in heaven. I mean, it's very vague, very confusing. I mean, it used to be grabbed a woman, dragged her into your tent, had sex with her, and then she was your wife, you know?
That's right.
It's not that way anymore.
Yeah.
And it's and our whole idea about sex has changed. I mean, sex to us was like some kind of a freaky, scary, sacred kind of moment where you exchange souls, kind of like, I don't know.
Right.
Soul breathers or
whatever. Right. Some kind of like vampire blood transfusion thing happened in there or something.
Like a holy thing. And our kids don't think that way at all. Sex to many kids these days is recreational. It's not even about relationship. Where kissing, I'm being open and honest here, where kissing is way more intimate than having sex. Mm. And so it's just, we're living in interesting times. Now, Lisa and I, we've gone through many stretches where we've had difficulty in our marriage. But the one when I left the ministry, if there was a year or two there where it was really, really tough.
Yeah.
And I actually had some people say to me, leave her, you know, go, if you're not happy, leave.
Wow.
And I'm like, okay, wait, I'm thinking to myself, probably the worst time to make a wise decision is when I'm confused. So I'm going to wait until there's some clarity. I'm loyal to a fault.
I'll
admit that.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to make a stupid decision while I was confused. Because I actually pictured myself as some old fart in a one-room apartment, a glass of scotch in one hand, a cigar in the other hand, stirring craft dinner on the stove all by himself.
Right.
Like, seriously. Did I want that?
Right.
Or did I want to wait until I had some clarity and see, did Lisa and I have a chance together? And I'm glad we waited, because the clarity came. We made sense of it. And we're now in a far healthier relationship than we've ever been. But there's some people who, like I know many people, I hear from people every day who are in horrible relationships.
Yeah.
I mean, it is horrible.
Yeah.
Lisa's and I relationship overall has been blissful with periods of horribleness.
Right. Right. I get it.
Whereas for many people I talk to, their relationship is horrible with occasional bouts of bliss.
Yeah.
But it's very, very, very sad. And I recommend, I'm going to say it right up front. I recommend, hey, if you can find a way out, do it. It's not going to work. You're never going to be happy. That's my prediction. And, you know, especially if they're living in with a narcissist or an abusive person or whatever, I strongly recommend, because I really do believe that, the health of the well-being of an individual is way more important than a belief. I stick to that. And, I recommend people, when I see that they're in a bad relationship, an abusive relationship, a toxic, dysfunctional, narcissistic relationship, get out. Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, it's as you talk, I still have a lot of, you know, I grew up in evangelicalism, homeschooled, the whole nine, you know.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
A lot of those deep-seated beliefs, even though I have come so far over the past even couple of years with a lot of my theology and beliefs, you know, as you talk that way, there are little voices that come up like, well, like, is that God honoring? Well, is that like commitment? And it just kind of shows, I think, how ingrained to a fault what I think is a good concept. Hey, you stick through tough times, right? And get clarity has become, well, even if you're being abused, you stick in that marriage. I mean, John Piper has a quote, I think from like 10 years ago, of him pretty much saying that to a woman who asked a question. And he pretty much says, like, you know, maybe you take a slap or two, you know, and it's like, whoa, like, wow. And I think I think it just shows how far off track what is, at least for a time or a season, was a good idea, right, has been really twisted to empower abusive men to maintain dominion and authority over women at their expense and, you know, at the sake of their well-being. And for a lot of people, including me sometimes, you know, I have to really trust that logical part over the what I've been indoctrinated with part. And that can be tough sometimes, frankly.
No, I get it. I mean, it's so embedded. It's like computer code. It's just really embedded in our DNA, and it's really hard to shake it. I know. I totally get it. But like, you know, people talk about, like Jesus said, Moses granted divorce because of hardness of heart. And we immediately assume that the hardness of heart was the person who wanted to get divorced. I think it's the opposite. The hardness of heart came from the person who refused to make this a good marriage.
Yeah.
And the other person had to go. But in Jesus' day, I don't know if women divorced men. It was always men divorced women. It was like them getting rid of, you know, one of their wives or whatever. Right. And then, you know, he says, God hates divorce. I hate divorce too. It's not nice. It's not pretty. It's not fun.
Yeah.
But it's something that happens, and we need to, you know, I have friends and loved ones who've gone through divorce. It's very sad. Yeah. I hate it. Yeah. They hate it. Nobody loves it, but it's something that had to happen in order for one and maybe both to live better lives. Mm-hmm. So we totally get the default system that we've had in our heads. Still to this day, it crops up. You know, it's like an echo, and it keeps cropping up. But we need to get to that place where we can make a decision.
Yeah.
Based on what's best here for whatever is going on, and so. Yeah. It's like what Till Doubt Do Us Part. My goal in this book is to help people survive deconstruction and in their marriage. But I do have a disclaimer that sometimes it doesn't work, because a lot of people, and you probably know people like this, a lot of people got married because they had to, or it's the only way they could have sex.
Yep.
Or they had a prophetic word that they should.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you need all kinds of bad reasons why they should have got married.
Yeah.
And I think that would, in any court, null and void the marriage contract.
I do tell a lot of, you know, whenever followers ask me, like, hey, you know, do you and your wife have these moments? And of course, no marriage is perfect, you know, and I would agree, as of right now, our marriage is very blissful. I'm blessed, I guess, to have a great marriage, a great wife. She's phenomenal. But something that has helped us survive is that I tell people that if you can't make room for each other, you're going to have problems. Like what you said earlier in our conversation, you know, you realize that you had to make room for your wife to be able to practice her spirituality in maybe a different way than you, and vice versa. It had to be a two-way street of both parties saying, I don't understand it, but I affirm it. And vice versa, right? And it does seem like, I don't know these marriages personally, but it seems like a lot of people are just kind of scared. And I think that's because deconstruction, especially when you first start realizing what's happening, right? Like you start realizing, oh no, This is what it's called. And I tell people, it's like you just jumped off the cliff. You can't see the bottom. You're praying there's a bed of feathers, but you're afraid that maybe there's spikes. And this is the end, you know, theologically for you. Yeah. And you have this like crisis of theology, I'll say. And because you're already in that fight or flight mode, you're then thinking like the worst case scenario about your marriage too, right? Because everything is just on edge. Your faith life is on edge. That ties into your identity, and that puts you on edge. And then you're thinking about your spouse who isn't getting what you're saying, and that puts you on edge. That deconstruction mode puts everyone just straight on edge. I think that can contribute a lot to that scariness of it.
So this is the core of deconstruction, in my opinion.
Yeah.
The core of deconstruction is when we move from depending upon authority and adopted, inherited beliefs and the status quo, the crowd, the herd, the system, everything, and we move to our own independence. It's basically the difference between adolescence and young adulthood, where we realize our parents can't control us, even though they try, and we're bucking against their authority and their power, and we move out in order to start establishing a life of our own, an independent life of our own. And it's the same spiritually, where we're moving from believing everything our parents say, depending upon them for everything, all our needs and wants and security and safety and home and food and everything. And we're moving out to become completely independent. And that's scary because we have to learn how to do things on our own. We need to learn how to make money. We need to learn how to feed ourselves. We need to learn how to form relationships. We need to learn how to make choices.
Right.
We need to learn how to find a home and make a home. We need to learn how to love and, you know, et cetera. And so it's the same spiritually. That's what's so freaking scary about it. Is because we're moving out from our parent of religion and the church into our own independence. But we keep hearing the echoes of our religion, our church, our parents, and their voices are stuck in our head while we try to establish what we know to be right and true and healthy for us. It's like walking into a buffet. I'm not going to serve myself everything that's being served. I'm going to serve myself what I like and what I know is healthy for me. Mm. And so it's the same with spirituality and religion and, you know, all that. A lot of the people that are listening to you right now even are probably in that place where they're trying to figure out, okay, how do I be spiritual? And in a way that, you know, And in the meantime, they're hearing these voices. We've already told you how to be spiritual.
Right.
We already gave you the rules. We already gave you a map, you know, you need to stay under this hedge of protection or the umbrella of authority or whatever.
Right.
And so it's really, really frightening. But if you keep doing it after a while, like I'm an adult now. I'm totally confident I'm living my life right. And the same will happen with you spiritually, where after a while you'll realize you are the master of your destiny. You are the captain of your ship and you've got the steering wheel in your hands of your spiritual life. And it's healthier that way. It's good that way.
Yeah. So I don't want to put you in a box. I'm curious. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know, you know, how would you identify, right, you know, for you, like spiritually, like, for example, you know, my account is the New Evangelical. So clearly I'm still identifying somewhere in the evangelical camp, but it's really more of like a Wesleyan tradition that I'm trying to reclaim, this, you know, egalitarian, social justice minded, abolition now, you know, for its time kind of movement that really was the birth of the evangelical movement that has now been completely hijacked by fundamentalism, right? And people ask me all the time, well, like, Tim, like, what do you believe? And I'm like, listen, something about Jesus, like, that's what I know. I'm trying to follow this Jesus person. And like, some days I affirm the resurrection. Some days I'm like, did he really do that? You know, like, I hold those things in tension, but I still believe it, right? But, you know, some people are in different spots. So where do you find yourself somewhere in that Jesus camp? Are you more in the spiritual camp these days? Where do you find yourself?
So that's your background, Wesleyan?
No, I'm discovering it. My background is fundamentalism and John MacArthurism, pretty much.
Oh wow!
But I'm reading. I just read a great book called "Discovering an Evangelical Heritage." It's like 110 pages long, and it's this author in the 60s who's like, "Listen, guys, fundamentalism has taken over. We should reclaim our heritage." And he wrote this book, and I'm reading it. I'm like, "These are my people." So I really found, you know, a beautiful buried tradition, but it's there. But yeah, that my background is much more fundamentalist and reformed, kind of in one.
Oh, okay. Because Wesleyanism is pretty strong where I am here in Atlantic Canada.
Mm.
Well, I just posted one of my memes last night on one of my pretty watercolor paintings, and I have one of my sayings on there where my home is in Christianity, but I have cottages everywhere. And so in 2009, I'll tell you a little bit of a story.
Sure.
In 2009, I had a certain of an epiphany.
Mm.
I don't know how to describe it because it wasn't like a vision or a revelation. It was just like I saw something in my mind. And I saw in a moment that we were all one and connected. There's one reality and we're all a part of it. There's one reality. Capital R, we're all a part of it. And, but there are as many interpretations and explanations of that reality as there are people, millions of interpretations. And so I realized in that moment that even though there's one reality, there's, we seem to be divided, although we're not really, we just seem to be divided by words, language, and the words we choose to describe this one reality. There's only one reality. There's not two, three, four without. There's only one. But you have your way of explaining it. I have my way of explaining it. The Bible writers have their way of explaining it. We're all attempting to describe this profound thing we call reality, or the profound mystery we call reality.
Yeah.
And so that's where I'm at now, where I'm serious when I say my home is in Christianity. It is. It's in my roots. It's in my DNA. I'm not going to reject it. I'm not going to try to throw it out. I'm not going to dismiss it. It's there. It's part of who I am, but it's in my roots that has grown my tree way out beyond and includes everything. So that I have respect for Buddhism and Hinduism and atheism and science and physicists and mysticism, and all that are all an attempt with their own words to explain this one reality we all partake in. Yeah. So that's where I am. So I'm very comfortable talking with Christians. I'm very comfortable talking with atheists or scientists or Buddhists or whatever, because we might not be sharing exactly the same words, but we're sharing the same attempt to describe this one reality that we're all taking part in.
Mm.
So that's where I am. And it might sound vague to some people, but it's not. I'm very, this is a fundamental dogmatic statement I'm making that there is one reality that we all share, and we're all just doing our best to try to explain it. And so that's, to me, that's what the Bible's about. It's like 66 books or letters of people pointing at something.
Yeah.
It's not the truth. They're pointing at the truth in their own way, in their own language, in their own culture, in their own words. And that's what I think, that's why I'm at where I'm at, I think there's such a diversity to the people who are in my community online.
Yeah.
And also why I upset people is because I'm not specific enough with my words.
Yeah, I feel that. I think that's really good. It's for me, as you talk, I'm like, And I see a lot of that even in the, like you said, in the Bible, you know, like I was talking to Trip Fuller. I'm not sure if you know who he is. He's a great theologian. I had him on a couple episodes ago. That guy, we talked for almost 2 hours. I was like, dude, my wife's making dinner. I got to go, but I want to keep going with you. But he makes the point that, you know, the four gospel accounts don't line up like factually, you know, like Luke's gospel ends with Jesus saying one thing and in a different gospel, Jesus says something different. And his point is like, maybe it's not about the camcorder footage of the story being factually all lined up, but it's about the experience that each of these authors had with this Jesus and how they had to tell the story some way, somehow, this perspective of how he changed everything. And I was like, you know, that really reconciles, even for me, questions that I've had in the past, you know, of like, I've been taught to read the Bible a certain way, but the more I try and read it that way, the more it doesn't fit. And so some people, and I've been tempted just to say, well, it's all a bunch of rubbish. But instead of that, putting it in its cultural context and understanding that these authors have a story to tell, what is the story, I think is a much more beautiful way, and maybe even a more reconcilable way of viewing these stories that actually speak to a greater reality, like you pointed out.
Yeah, well, you know, if you read literature from that period and region, there's a lot of similarities, like in Egypt and Rome, Greece, you know, the Middle East. There's a lot of similarities in the way they conveyed and communicated meaning. So, you know, today, you know, you go into a bookstore, you've got fiction, nonfiction. Whereas in those days, there wasn't such a dichotomy. And so that, you know, the idea that somehow the gospel writers were journalists.
Right.
It's just a false and inappropriate way to appreciate. There was no such thing back then.
Right. It didn't exist.
They were conveying meaning.
Yes.
In a way that was congruent with the way meaning was conveyed in their culture and time. So, you know, there's other literature out there that's not Christian that talks about, you know, virgin births and feeding multitudes, you know, miraculously, and walking on water and healing the sick.
Right.
And being resurrected and being executed and going into heaven. And like it's pervasive in the literature of that time and place. Mm. And because that's the way they conveyed truth about their heroes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we need to take that kind of stuff into account when we're if we love the Bible, we should try to know the Bible as it is and love it as it is rather than what we wish it to be.
No, I love that. You know, Tim Mackey from the Bible Project says often that you know, this is not camcorder footage. Someone wasn't down there with their video camera, like, you know, and they're not telling you the camcorder footage of story of events. Oftentimes they're not doing that. And that's okay, because there's a different meaning that they're trying to communicate. It's the idea of, you know, for us to put a modern Western, you know, Enlightenment lens on the Bible is going to be very problematic, because the authors in the Bible are not concerned at all about any of those categories. They just do not care, because it didn't exist then. And the more I learn that, the more I'm like, wow, I love the Bible more than ever, actually, because of that. Because I'm freed from trying to squeeze it into my context, I can enter someone else's context and how, you know, the divine impacted what, you know, this story is big, is just, it's beautiful. So my last question for you, and I, again, appreciate making time and coming on, and it was just such a great dialogue. You know, do you have any wisdom as someone who is in a different all right, the end, you know, I mean, I feel like, and I know for a fact that yes, a lot of people who are older than me are deconstructing. I know that, but it's very concentrated. I feel like in this, you know, 23 to like 38 year old range, it's like a big bullseye right now. And frankly, our culture in the West doesn't allow for a healthy elder, you know, like relationship of, you know, I have wisdom and we pass it down. So whenever I have someone who's just in a different spot than I am, I want to soak it up. Do you have any insight or wisdom, you know, for us who are trying to deconstruct our fundamentalism or evangelicalism for the first time? We're freaking out. We don't know what we're doing. doing. You know, what do you have for us? Anything?
Well, one of my joys in life is my Instagram account. So Naked Pastor on Instagram, go there, follow me, and we'll have fun. I do a lot of work there to keep the community clear of bullies and trolls and hate and everything. But, and we talk all about deconstruction there. And you're right. It's a lot of younger adults, and the majority are women.
Yep.
And I think that's because, I'll be honest with you, women are starting to rise up. They're like, I'm done with this.
That's right.
You know, authority under men and the patriarchy and white
totally.
And all that. And they're the bravery and the courage of these women is just astounding.
I mean, that is my theory too, by the way. I've told people that. I said, I think it's because they've been under men's thumb for so long, and they're finding that they can finally say what they want on social media, and we're given, you know, an outlet for it.
Some of the wildest, bravest, courageous warrior women I know are in the Bible belts around the world.
Totally.
And I just admire them so much, and they're such an inspiration. So here's my advice.
All right.
And this is what a lot of people say once they, you know, hang out with us for a while is, oh my goodness, I'm not crazy. I'm not alone.
Yep.
I'm actually growing.
Yeah.
This is a good thing. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
Like, so don't, I know it's hard not to freak out and not to worry and not to get afraid. I remember lying in my bed, breaking out in a cold sweat, thinking I'm going to go to hell because I didn't believe in hell.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
How crazy is that?
Yeah.
Right? Well, I remember that, but it passes. I promise you. Keep growing. That'll pass. At first, it's a loud voice. They're shouting. Then it becomes a faint, you know, raspy voice. Then it becomes a whisper. Then it becomes an echo. Then it fades away. It will. I promise you. It'll fade away. Just keep growing. And, you know, enjoy the ride. This is growth. You're not trying to get through something. You're not trying to get over something. You're not in OR, you know, post operation, trying to get over something. This is growth. This is what life is. Enjoy it. This is the process. The process is the destination.
Yeah.
So enjoy yourself. This is fun, and embrace it as a wonderful time in your spiritual journey.
Yeah. Well said. David, thank you for making time. I'll make sure I post a link in the show notes to your Instagram account. Anywhere else people can find you?
Nakedpastor.com.
You got it. Well, I'm sure we'll do this again. My account loves you. I get your stuff sent all the time. So keep it up. You're doing great stuff.
Thanks. You too.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.